Freedom Decrypted is sponsored by Think Penguin and Liberty Minded. Streaming live from our Keene, New Hampshire studios, this is your host, Christopher Wade, and I'm in the studio today with Mr. Penguin here. It's a big blow-up penguin, as often seems to be the case these days. Don't always have a co-host. So we're going to get into our current episode, I guess, of Freedom Decrypted. I did tease a bit about a story on El Salvador. Basically, they're adopting Bitcoin as their official currency, and apparently the IMF is not happy. I think we're going to go ahead and start off with this story. So here we go. IMF, oh, and by the way, this is coming from Reuters.com. IMF sees legal economic issues with El Salvador's Bitcoin move. So they're not happy. The International Monetary Fund logo is seen outside the headquarters building in Washington, D.C., U.S., September, blah, blah, blah. Okay, that's just a summary of the picture that doesn't show on my screen at the moment. The International Monetary Fund said on Thursday it has economic and legal concerns regarding the move by El Salvador. Now, if I'm not mistaken, El Salvador is a independent country, and I'm not entirely sure what the legal concerns are. If they want to adopt, you know, Bitcoin or, you know, feathers as their currency, national currency, that's their business. Nobody else is forced to accept it. To make Bitcoin a parallel legal tender, further clouding the outlook for an IMF-backed program and widening spreads on the country's bonds. El Salvador has become the first country in the world to adopt Bitcoin as legal tender, with President Nayib Bukele touting its use for its potential to help Salvadorans living abroad to send remittances back home. Adoption of Bitcoin as legal tender raises a number of macroeconomic, financial, and legal issues that require very careful analysis, said Jerry Rice, an IMF spokesman, during scheduled press briefing. We are following developments closely and will continue our consultations with the authorities. Foreign investors concerned about the future of an IMF deal they see as key for the Central American country have demanded increasingly higher premiums to hold Salvadorian debt. You know what's interesting about this is that's probably not a good thing anyway. Like, you know, I mean, there's a certain amount of debt that, you know, is probably good to have, like, on an individual basis, but it seems like a country spending money that it needs to borrow is probably not the best of moves. I mean, you're basically indenturing your people to something they may or may not even be able to pay back. If it's going to be borrowed, it should be borrowed by individuals, not the government. The spread of the J.P. Morgan EMBI Global Diversified Index over safe haven U.S. Treasuries jumped by 61 basis points on Thursday alone to trade at 683 basis points, the highest level since February 22nd. The daily average move over the past 21 trading sessions is 1.86 BPS. We see the Bitcoin headlines out of El Salvador as noise that could complicate the discussions with the IMF. Good, said Citi's Donato Guarino in a recent note to clients, reducing the bank's already underweight exposure to the country even further. Rice said the fund will later on Thursday meet with Bukele to discuss the Bitcoin law. El Salvador is in discussions with the IMF seeking a near $1 billion program. The crypto is very marginal story to the Salvadorian investment thesis, said Patrick Esterles, research head at MSO Asset Management in New York. Whether El Salvador is going to be attractive for investors or not is going to depend on Bukele's ability to use his unquestionable political capital to bring a large consolidated fiscal deficit into control. Ooh, wow. Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. It's like, stop indebting the people, stop taking on these loans. I get that there's a certain amount of like, you know, facilities that like businesses need to operate and so on, they need to be invested in, but it doesn't necessarily have to come from government, you know, stealing from the people to achieve those objectives. I think this is one of the best things that's could potentially happen for El Salvador is this whole, I mean, it doesn't, your country doesn't have to adopt it. They just have to let people be, you know, in order for crypto to be adopted. But I presume there's going to be some sort of benefit here. And it sounds almost like a big FU to the world's governments. El Salvador law means Bitcoin will have equal footing with the dollar, which became, and this is almost like, oh, so basically what they're doing is they're saying, please don't invade. We're going to adopt Bitcoin. But we're also going to adopt the US dollar, which became its official currency 20 years ago. The law by itself does not assuage doubt about the feasibility of the project, nor does it add any confidence the development will put the IMF program back on track. Okay, yeah. Let's see. El Salvador bonds were trading lower in price across the curve on Thursday. Okay. Yeah, it doesn't sound like it's that big of a deal. All right. So there's not, unfortunately, there's not that much to this story. But anyway, it's still an interesting move. And I didn't, I did cut the original story out that kind of announced it. And then this is kind of a counter story to it, but I figured that was probably sufficient. ArsTechnica.com is reporting Amazon eBay fight legislation that would unmask third-party sellers. Now, this seems like a good thing, like on the front, but I don't think it is. I think this is actually kind of a bad thing. You know, if you don't want the risk of buying from a third-party seller on Amazon, don't buy from a third-party seller on Amazon, right? Like, there's a certain amount of cost when you put liability on the seller or the manufacturer, and there are choices that society has to make, and if they're willing to accept that risk, that's on them, you know, from not being able to, you know, sue or whatever it is, you know, the seller that the third party seller in this case. And basically, what this is effectively doing is it's forcefully raising the prices for everybody. Who currently benefits from the lower prices from third-party sellers not having a liability in at least some cases, for the products they sell. But the consequence may be in some instances that the product that you are buying is fake or it's dangerous or, you know, whatever. And that's kind of a risk that you're taking. And there's a reason that, you know, you may not want to buy from a third-party seller if they don't have a good reputation. And there's different ways, you know, to figure that out, right? So I think this is the free market in action, if anything. And sometimes, you know, it's okay to accept liability, you know, for the products you know are buying, you know, especially depending on what it is. And some of these examples that they give that we're supposed to be outraged about are just ridiculous. So let me get into this a little bit. So yeah, Amazon. Well, before we do, let me just give a summary of it. So Amazon and a who's who of online retailers are trying to kill a proposed federal and state legislation that would make the companies disclose contact information for third-party sellers. Yeah, I mean, they're basically it's they're trying to force Amazon to identify the third-party sellers for liability reasons and so on. And it's not that it's not necessarily a bad thing, you know, to be able to sue, but it's sort of like this thing that also increases costs of doing business. So it isn't always necessarily in the people's interest to force that as the only option. Right now, you have two options. You could go to Walmart and purchase something and they're liable for it. Or you could go to Amazon and purchase it from a third-party seller and they're not liable for it. So therefore they have lower costs. You know, those are things that, you know, you can see in the prices often, just by doing a little bit of comparison shopping. And I'm not a fan of Amazon by any stretch of the imagination. I don't like Amazon, but that doesn't mean that Amazon should be, you know, regulated, you know, or forced into doing this, because at the end of the day, it's undermining free market competition. So, So basically, this is sort of also, it's, it comes off to me as a brick and mortar retailer against a big technology company, effectively, is what it's coming down to. Or it's the it's not really just Amazon, it's the brick and mortar retailers, traditional brick and mortar retailers like Walmart, against Amazon and the e-tailers, so to speak. And I don't even necessarily know it's against all e-tailers. I mean, let's be honest here. Think Penguin doesn't exactly hide, we don't exactly hide, who to sue potentially. It's some, and it's mostly eBay and Amazon, and I'm not sure who else, maybe Newegg. I think Newegg has some third-party sellers, and maybe Walmart does too, I think. So anyway, but certainly there is a certain group who is trying to kind of level the playing field. And really, the solution to the problem is probably to allow everybody to do this. You know, it's like, let's not just allow Amazon to hide third-party sellers. Let's allow Amazon to hide itself. Let's allow Walmart to hide its, liabilities too. I mean, effectively, all it should amount to is disclaimers, we're not liable for the products that we sell. And then you might not want to buy from them, right? Unless they can show that the products that they sell are generally safe and, good and whatever else. And then in which case it's cheaper to buy from them, and therefore you probably should, over the company that's, selling you a faulty product and, is liable, but, folds the moment that, they get a lawsuit against them, or sufficient enough lawsuit. But that might not happen right away. So in the meantime, they're profiting, taking money from the company and folding anyway, and you get nothing at the end of the day. So it's not like just because they identify, you're going to be able to sue them anyway, or they're going to be liable. I mean, there's all sorts of different ways that companies operate. Often, actually, there, even before this, there were, I'm sure that I've read or talked about, possibly on this show, stories where you have these companies, Chinese companies, that they set up these U.S. operations, ship the product to the U.S., the product is faulty, effectively, sell out of that product. So they'll sell, I don't know how many, maybe 100,000 of a particular item, and then they'll fold the company, ship the profits back. There's nobody to sue by the time you get the product. And it was, a company that effectively identified itself, but because it never retained assets in the United States, and then it folds, immediately at the conclusion of that product being sold, there's no opportunity to actually bring a lawsuit or extract money. I mean, the company's effectively already shipped out its, profits, overseas and out of the eyes of, civil cases in the United States, civil law to go after or to claw back. All right. Let's see here. So one of the things I wanted to read on this one was basically the examples that they're giving, which were just absolutely insane. Here we go. Even a non-counterfeit items bought from third-party sellers have been implicated in consumer harm. In April 2018, a 19-month-old in Texas was injured after, and you might think, okay, so there's this child product, they should have a higher level, a higher standard, right? But wait, we're gonna keep reading, because this gets even more absurd. After ingesting a battery that fell out of a loose battery compartment in a third-party Apple TV remote. Are you giving your Apple TV remote to a 19-month-old? I mean, this just sounds like idiot parenting, there are some things, this is not a product that was designed for your baby to chew on, right? It's a product that may not be safe for your, to have around your, I don't know if you call them an infant or baby or whatever. This idea that Apple should, or not Apple, but this third party, TV remote company should be liable because you were stupid and you did something really terrible, and you risked your child's, I don't know if they risked their child's life, but whatever. The point is, if they did risk their child's life or injury or whatever, it's not always on some third party manufacturer of cheap crap, basically. It's on you as the parent, or you know, whoever, you know, put that thing in that region where you knew, you know, a baby who doesn't necessarily understand, you know, what they're doing all the time, you know, is gonna potentially become at risk of some sort of danger. The parents asked Amazon to stop selling the defective product and requested contact information for the company who ran the Amazon store, USA Shopping 7693, that sold the remote. The individual never responded for the company, and Amazon was not able to locate the individual. So, I mean, basically, okay, so what they're saying is that this, there was an individual who operated a store under the USA Shopping 7693 handle, I guess. And this individual sounds like they're probably Chinese, and you know, I don't even know if they have a U.S. operation, really, but they're shipping stuff to Amazon, presumably, and Amazon is reshipping the items to goods and collecting payment for that individual. The parents sued Amazon in Texas state court, arguing that the retailer is liable for the defective product. Amazon, on the other hand, and here's the problem, Amazon very clearly lists third-party sellers versus what they're selling themselves. So it shouldn't be unclear to anybody, you know, if you actually pay attention to what you're buying and read, which I know there's so many people out there who just are incapable of, like, don't even have a fifth grade reading level in the United States that can't or are too lazy to read, you know, the description, the product description slash, and I'm not even talking about like blatantly misleading. I'm just talking about it's in the same location every time you buy something from Amazon. Okay. Just look on the right-hand side. It says who the seller is, where it ships from, basically. Does it ship from Amazon or does it ship from the seller itself? It tells you all of that right in the same location on every product page on Amazon, or more or less anyway. There might be something on Amazon like in the like groceries or something like that that it's not a little bit differently. But more or less, it's basically in the same spot on every product page. So you can't possibly claim, you know, ignorance here in terms of who you are buying from. It's very apparent that you are buying from, you know, basically a no-name, you know, company that, you know, and don't get me wrong, there are certainly companies on Amazon that have a reputation, I would say, but not everybody does. And it's up to you to make a decision of, do I buy from that company? Does that company sell garbage? Does that company, you know, resolve issues, you know, in a proper way? And some of this you can get a feel for from reviews. Now, I know people are going to be like, yeah, but the reviews are fake and, you know, all this other stuff. Well, you know, you can read the reviews and you can get it. You can gauge roughly, you know, whether or not they've been, you know, faked and so on. And there's also this other thing you can do. You can simply not buy from Amazon based on the reviews. You know, there are other companies like thinkpenguin.com. We don't sell stuff that we wouldn't buy ourselves, right? And there's a reason for that. There is a market for basically products that don't suck, right? There is a lot of products on Amazon for specifically that are garbage. And I understand that a lot of people don't want garbage. Well, that doesn't mean you have to buy from Amazon. You can go elsewhere. And you choose where you want to buy from. If you want a reputable, a reputable product from a reputable outlet, or you want a good product that maybe isn't a brand name product, but, you know, it's been evaluated, it's been looked at, and somebody said, yeah, this is, you know, this meets a certain standard. You know, maybe they're not saying it meets, you know, the top of the top, but it at least has, it's at least good. It's at least a good product that, you know, you would be probably content with. And, you know, maybe not pay too much for, or, you know, I mean, there's different companies doing different things and with different strategies, right? So you just have to find the company that's going to be doing what you want. And, you know, do a little bit of Google, do a little bit of research, see what other people say about that company or about that product or whatever. Amazon, on the other hand, says it serves as a middleman and bears no liability. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, it doesn't seem that unreasonable. And it's not like that there's no repercussions at all for selling garbage on Amazon as a third party seller. I am like 95% sure that like you can still return stuff, and like there's different ways. Amazon is still acting as like an intermediary, if I'm not mistaken. So it's not totally that there's nothing you can do when you get a bad product from a third-party seller on Amazon. It's just that your options may be more limited, you know, in terms of, oh, if this product is garbage and you use it anyway and you put it in your baby's hands and it kills your baby, well, you're effectively, the liability for Amazon is the cost of the product, right? It's not going to be a lawsuit where you're going to get millions of dollars because you lost your child for, because you were really the one doing something stupid by giving him a cheap and crappy product that then they ended up dying from. If anything, you're probably the one who should be criminally held criminally negligent, if anything, not Amazon, not even the seller of the product. Unless, I mean, maybe there's some sort of argument for like baby toys or, I don't know, something like, or whatever that's going to, I don't know, if I don't even know, or maybe food products or something, you know, that there's going to be more risk to or something. But it's not this. It's not a freaking remote. You know, a knockoff remote that is sold from a third-party seller via Amazon, where the latch to hold the batteries in, you know, doesn't work properly, and you decide to use it anyway, and you probably can see that it doesn't latch well or doesn't latch, you know, whatever, and you know, giving that to your baby to bite on or whatever that's not Amazon's fault. All right, let's see what else we got here. So yeah, and they go into kind of how they Amazon is destroying product from, you know, counterfeit products and, you know, unsafe products and things like that. And this is the thing, it's like, you know, the United States government it reviews like less than 1% of imports, something like that. It's like there's a very small amount of review of products coming into the United States for things that are unsafe, counterfeits, and or you know, dangerous items. You're really on your own to a large degree when it comes to this sort of thing. I mean, if something doesn't look right when you buy a product, it's kind of on you to deal with. And this is also one of the reasons why you should probably buy certain products, you know, from outlets that are less likely to give you something, you know, that's counterfeit, right? It's not like it's going to be 100% perfect all the time, but you know, an outlet that at least stands up, you know, and, you know, is reasonably consistently good most of the time is probably a safer outlet to buy from than, I don't know, some other outlet that, you know, doesn't have that kind of high reputation, you know. Some like eBay, for example, you know, a lot of people on eBay, they will buy, you know, basically the defective product, sell it to you at a discount. Maybe not a discount, maybe a full price even, but they'll sell it to you. Well, they have a model, and maybe the product works some most of the time or something like that, but it still doesn't meet the higher standard, right? And so some of those retailers, they have really bad reputations, and others, you know, they have decent reputations, but it's still the same product. And so there's different, like, there's just different levels. And eBay even now has reviews for the individual products as well as the sellers. So like there's multiple different things that have changed over the years as far as, and don't get me wrong, eBay is like one of those outlets that's, you can get garbage and you can also get stuff that's okay, you know, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's on you to do the evaluating to some degree. All right. Let's see here. So that's pretty much the gist of it. I think there was another example here that was also kind of like ridiculous, but I must have skipped it over somehow. Yeah, I'm not. I thought there was two examples, but maybe there weren't. Yeah, anyway, they're I think both of the examples, and maybe there was only one, maybe I'm mistaken, we're just so ridiculous with this story. All right. Let's see here. We got another story here from The Guardian. Global banking regulators call for toughest rules for cryptocurrencies. We're going to cover the story in just a moment. We're going to take a short break, and when we get back, we will get into it.
We'd like to invite you to visit FreeKeen.com. FreeKeen.com features audio, video, and blogs chronicling the transition to a voluntary society. FreeKeen.com also has comments and discussion forums so you can be heard. FreeKeen.com.
I should be in Keene, New Hampshire with the Free Staters.
If you haven't shopped at libertyminded.com, you're missing out. The company's got lots of great t-shirts, such as voting outside of a two-party system is a wasted vote because the candidate will not win, because voting outside of the two-party system is a wasted vote because the candidate will not win, because voting outside, I think you get the idea. Talk about circular reasoning. Did you know that Fedora the Explorer, exploring free software one distro at a time, is one of my favorite t-shirts? It's a great t-shirt for any distro hoppers in your life. Liberty Minded has lots of great t-shirts like this and many others. How about, I was reported to the FBI, but they just ignored it? Or, no, you can't be my friend. I'm not on Facebook. Which may or may not really be related. Now this is one that all hackers can agree on. Intellectual property is really information slavery. Information just wants to be free. And if the last one was too wordy, how about intellectual property is neither? Join liberty-minded voluntarists, anarchists, and libertarians this summer from June 13th until June 18th for ForkFest 2019 at Rogers Campground in the beautiful White Mountains of New Hampshire. ForkFest happens right before the Porcupine Freedom Festival, and ForkFest is decentralized, which means no one is in charge. That also means there's no ticket cost. Just reserve your camping or RV site or motel room with Rogers Campground for June 13th through June 18th. You can simply relax and go camping with other liberty lovers, or you can create whatever experience or event you'd like others to have. If you're planning an event for ForkFest, be sure to let others know in advance. You can connect with other ForkFesters via the unofficial Telegram chat or the ForkFest forum. Links to those are on the unofficial website, ForkFest.party. Check out ForkFest.party.
I want to talk to you about privacy online and what you can do to protect yourself. Now, you might be thinking it's too hard. Well, not any longer. With our privacy-friendly Penguin VPN service, it's easier than ever to get a baseline of protection. We have guides for many popular GNU Linux distributions and releases. Whether you're on Trisco, Ubuntu, Linux Mint, or even Parabola, we have a solution for you. And if reading is a challenge, check out our mini VPN wireless routers that optionally come pre-configured with Penguin VPN service. All you have to do is plug the router in and select the wireless access point from your computer. After that, all your data is transparently passed through our privacy-friendly VPN servers. We can protect you from rogue ISPs, corporations, and even government censorship. We sponsor the development of the only fully Libre embedded distribution shipping on routers today, and have a reputable third party vet the code. Routers are RYF certified by the Free Software Foundation. Check out thinkpenguin.com, click on networking, and you can find our VPN services and routers available there.
Streaming live from our Keene, New Hampshire studios, you are listening to Freedom Decrypted or watching live. So check out freedomdecrypted.com if you are not watching a live show. The show airs every Saturday from 5 to 8 p.m. Sometimes it starts a little bit late, but usually it starts around right around 5, 5:15, something like that. You can also download a audio version of the show in a podcast format, basically, because mostly it's audio. But we do have a little bit of video here and there. So it is always a great show to watch, too. But sometimes it's just the audio more mostly. All right. There's a coupon code also that I want to give out as a thank you for listening or watching Freedom Decrypted. So if you check out thinkpenguin.com, and you use the coupon code RMS, all caps, you can get a 3% discount on anything at thinkpenguin.com. I believe if you're in the United States, there might be a few restrictions on that. And there's another freebie here too with shipping if you use cryptocurrency. Basically, to get that
offer, you just have to click on, well, one, you have to use cryptocurrency. So you got to click on the BitPay or Bitcoin Cash option at the bottom, and then go back up to shipping and select click the calculate shipping button. And then it will give you a free shipping option. That I think that doesn't apply for scanners and printers, but it applies to everything else. And that is restricted definitely within the United States. So there are some other options. There's some also other discounts as well that you can get your hands on. If you send a GPG encrypted email to chris@thinkpenguin.com, that's me, I will send a response, as long as you attach your public GPG key, I will respond to you in encrypted format with the discount code for that. Now, that's a 2% discount. You can combine that 2% discount with the 3% discount. That will give you a 5% discount, right? There's another discount you can get as well, and that discount is also a 2% discount, and that basically is if you sign up for the thinkpenguin.com mailing list. Now, there's not a whole heck of a lot of messages or emails that go out, but basically there is a newsletter sort of thing that goes out like once or maybe twice at most a year, probably on average. So sign up for the thinkpenguin.com mailing list, get yourself a 2% discount. You don't even have to worry about, you know, getting spammed or anything like that, because we just don't use it much. We're terrible at marketing. What can I say? And those, that free shipping offer, all of that, all those three coupons there, they can all be used together. So ultimately at the end of the day, that's up to a 7% discount at thinkpenguin.com, as well as the free shipping, which depending on the product, that can be like more than 30%. So it depends on the product. Basically the way it's arranged is if there's a higher profit margin on it, then it's probably you're going to get a bigger discount. Whereas if there's a lower profit margin, the discount is not quite as big, but we can't afford a bigger discount because, like, for example, there's like a 10% profit margin on like computers, for example, and that's throughout the whole chain. So we're like, we couldn't give you a 30% discount without losing money on it. So it ends up working out just fine. That doesn't mean you don't get a good deal. You do. It's just that we can't give you as good of a deal on the computers as we can on like little accessory items where there's a higher profit margin on them. So, all right. So let's go ahead, get back into this story here. All right. So this is the story from The Guardian, where global banking regulators call for the toughest rules for cryptocurrencies. So bankers are getting angry. You're getting too good of a deal with cryptocurrencies. Global regulators have said cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin should come with the toughest bank capital rules to avoid putting the wider financial system at risk should their value collapse suddenly. Shouldn't that like risk be held with the person who's buying the cryptocurrency? You know, I mean, the fact that it's being counted at, you know, with the global economy is, I don't know. I think this is just exclude it from how you count, you do the counting, and it won't have an impact. I mean, I guess it sort of does have an impact still, because it will reduce, like, if the crypto falls, right, it will reduce somebody's ability to spend. You know, that's life. I mean, sometimes economies will do good and sometimes economies will not do good. The Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, which consists of regulators from the world's leading financial centers, is proposing a new conservative prudential treatment for crypto assets that would force banks to put aside enough capital to cover 100% of potential losses. So 100% of losses, that sounds to me, I don't know what people understand about this, but covering 100% of losses when 100% of losses are like probably never going to happen. Maybe 50%, you know, would make sense, you know, if you want to push it, but you know, that kind of depends on how much risk you want to accept, I think. And this idea that they should have to put 100% is kind of making me think that this is a story or a situation where effectively the bankers just don't like cryptocurrency because they're not gaining from it or profiting from it or something along those lines. That would be the highest capital requirement of any asset, illustrating that cryptocurrencies and related investments are seen as far more risky and volatile than conventional stocks or bonds. See, and here's the thing. Yeah, they might be right now, but it doesn't necessarily mean they always will be or they have to be. And if you start looking at this, the story comes off to me as an attack piece for other reasons as well. So they immediately go on to talk about how this won't apply to effectively what amounts to non-cryptocurrencies that are digital monies or currencies or however you want to phrase that. And what that would be a stable coin. And the reason that it won't apply to stablecoin, the real reason is effectively because stablecoins aren't cryptocurrencies. They may appear to be cryptocurrencies, but at the end of the day, there's somebody in control of those currencies, right? And they're pegged to the dollar. So they also come with more risk, I think, in a lot of ways, because they're tied to a company and because you don't know exactly what's going on behind the scenes. Like, you know what's going on behind Bitcoin, right? It's the blockchain's open, the sources are open for everything. You understand how it operates. That's not totally the case with a lot of these stable coins. You know, we don't know when they say, when a company sets up a stable coin, right? And they say they have $1 for every one stable coin, right? That they issue. You don't have any way to know that. You don't have any way to check that, right? So they may not. And if you look into some of these stable coins, you'll quickly realize that that's probably not, they probably don't have a one-to-one ratio like they're claiming. And so they've changed some things over the years too, to kind of obscure it even more, in that they say, well, now it's, well, we don't have $1 for every one stable coin. We have $1 worth of like assets for every stable coin. And so it gets into this territory of like, can they actually give you $1 back if everybody were to go and try and collect? And it, you know, and the thing is, it may not be that big of a deal if they don't, because you're not going to have, in most situations, you're not gonna have everybody running to take out their dollar, right, for every stablecoin at any one given time. There's this thing, I'm trying to think if this is called fractional reserve banking, but I think it is. But basically, like, that's not how dirty fiat currencies work, like the US dollar, right? They don't have $1 in the bank for every dollar they give out. It just doesn't work like that. Or they don't have one gold coin for every dollar that they give out, right? It just doesn't work that way. You know, the government doesn't work that way. And this idea that a stable coin has to work that way, it probably doesn't really. And there's no reason that you can't potentially do something similar with a stable coin. I'm going to put stable coin in quotes, but you know, you can't do something similar to the US dollar and roughly maintain its value. You can. It's just depending on what you do, you're risking. You're taking a risk, right? So right now, people trust stable coins because they supposedly are backed by, you know, things that don't go up or down, more or less, right? So however, if there's only, you know, 75%, they've only got 75% in dollars, and so they can give out, most people, even if there's a run on the banks, chances are they can give out, you know, $1 to everybody who turns in a stable coin, right? So they're gonna survive, right? So you're not too worried about it. But what happens when they only hold 50%, right? So they've only got, for every two stable coin they issue, they only have $1 in their bank account, right? At some point, it's going to get to a point where if there is a run on the banks, right, there is a run on the stable coin and people want to sell or get out of it because they think that there's not enough money in the bank. Well, what happens? You know, at a certain point, they won't be able to give you, they won't be able to give you your $1 for your one, you know, dollar worth of stable coin, basically. So, but the U.S. government, the dollar itself is not, you know, that is not necessarily worth, you know, what they're trying to make us believe it is either. And some of that is by manipulating gold, as I understand it. So they're basically unloading gold onto the market that, and there's like they're claiming to have gold in the vaults that doesn't exist in the vaults because they unloaded it onto the market. So there's like, there's this theoretically, when people are looking at gold prices, it's like based on more gold than actually exists. And so it kind of, it reduces the prices on gold, which makes, you know, people think that the dollar is retaining its value when really it's going down faster than it is. So if it says 3% inflation, well, maybe it's 10% inflation really, from 1 year to the next. So your dollar is losing value more than people think it is, based on like official statistics and things like that, that are kept, or I'll put official in quotes here, but the statistics that are government approved, so to speak. All right. Yeah, what else? I don't know if there's anything else here, but the UK lender NatWest has said it will refuse to serve business customers who accept payments in cryptocurrencies. Yeah, I mean, this is just like, alongside those made by debit, credit cards, and cash, even though it could mean turning away notable companies, including the ethical cosmetics firm Lush and office sharing firm WeWork. Yeah, I mean, this is literally just an attack, it sounds like, from the banks on those who are, you know, savvy with their money. While most authorities are starting to crack down on the use of crypto assets, some are taking a more open-minded approach. El Salvador announced this week that it would be the first country to adopt Bitcoin as legal tender, despite repeated warnings from the central banks that investors should be ready to lose all their cash. Yeah, it's not likely. I mean, cryptocurrencies, here's the problem. So cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, they can fall. I mean, we went from 30,000 to like 35 to 40,000 here, in a fairly short period of time. The problem is that that's up from like 20,000 or 10,000 even really. So it, what happens is every couple of years we end up going from like, and I'll give you an example. We went from like 2,000 to 20,000, then it fell to 10,000, but then it went from 10,000 to 60,000, and now we're at like 40,000, 30, 40,000, right? So we're still higher than we were a couple of years ago, a lot higher. So now averaging it out, right, you end up being, you know, perfectly fine. You end up doing really well, in fact. However, if you are, if all of your assets, like all of your paycheck is in, say, Bitcoin, right? And let's say you live, you know, paycheck to paycheck, and you get, let's say you get $1,000 a week, right? For your, I don't know, $1,000 a month, let's say $1,000 a month. All right. And okay. So reality is you're going to have a certain amount that you have to put away for food and for other expenses, right? Let's say that's $100 a month and $900 covers your rent, right? And you're getting $1,000 a month in your paycheck, right? And it's monthly. We'll say it's a monthly paycheck, right? And you're living paycheck to paycheck. So you're spending all that money every month, right? Well, if you get your paycheck in Bitcoin, right, it might go up, right? So maybe you'll actually have $1,200 this month. What happens, and but if you spend it all, what happens next month, right, when you get your paycheck in Bitcoin and initially you have $1,000, but you don't pay your mortgage right away or your rent or whatever it is, and all of a sudden Bitcoin falls and now you only have $600. Well, if your rent or mortgage is $900 and you have $600, you can't eat that month and you can't pay your mortgage that month or your rent. And so now you might say that's a problem, but that's only a problem if you have to, if you're relying on that money to maintain its value effectively in the short term. If you're not, and you've only invested or you've only put into Bitcoin what you can afford to effectively lose, then you really don't have that problem. So for people who are not living paycheck to paycheck, Bitcoin's a great thing. You could say, even for people living to paycheck, Bitcoin's a good thing. And it's probably true unless you're really like, you're starting to borrow money. If you're getting into the borrowing money territory, you already have problems, right? But if you're not borrowing money, right, in order to maintain your lifestyle, Bitcoin is, and cryptocurrencies are a great thing, because you just can't put more into it than you can afford to lose. And over time, you won't lose money. You'll gain money. You'll benefit from it over the long term, but only if you don't put more in than you can afford to lose, right? And so that is basically how it ends up. And even the people who aren't making a ton of money and more or less living paycheck to paycheck, if they're putting in just a little bit of money into their, you know, the money that they can afford to, maybe it's not a lot, maybe maybe it's $50 a month, let's say, right? If you have $50 a month that you can afford to lose and you put that into Bitcoin, and you, even if you're spending it, right, even if you're spending a little bit from that over time, you know, if you keep restocking that Bitcoin, dollar cost averaging, I think, something like that. Anyway, basically what it amounts to is, even if you're doing that, even if you're spending at the lows and you're spending at the highs and you're receiving at the highs and you're receiving at the lows, you know, refreshing that Bitcoin, in other words, overall, over time, you actually end up doing better than if you were to simply hold all your, you know, your assets in effectively dollars, right? If you have some of those assets, some of that value in crypto, you're going to be doing better off than somebody who has not. So you just have to like learn to manage your money better. And then crypto works out really well for people, regardless of how much money you have, more or less, as long as you're not borrowing, you're not getting into that territory where you're borrowing money. And of course, if you're borrowing money in order to pay your rent, you are paying too much for rent. You need to solve that problem. That's a bigger problem than putting your money into Bitcoin. You need to solve the problem that you're borrowing in order to, you know, either feed yourself or pay rent or whatever. You've got to solve that problem, and you can't really do that unless you maybe eat less, or you, I don't know, find a smaller place or whatever, something, you move somewhere else. There's certainly, you know, maybe you move out, maybe you live on the street for a while until you can save up enough money where you're in a better position, and then things will, you know, work out for you. But you've got to make the smart decisions. And sometimes living in a house or living in an apartment you can't afford is not the smart decision. Not everybody can afford to live in Manhattan, right? And by the way, Manhattan, like, you pay $1 million for like an apartment in Manhattan for like a one bedroom. So not everybody can afford to live in Manhattan, right? And so, but there are places, you know, that are cost effective to live, that you can afford them even on, you know, minimum wage. You can come up to New Hampshire and you can live on minimum wage. Now, I'm not saying you could support a family on minimum wage, but you can live as a single guy, you know, at 20 years old on minimum wage in New Hampshire. Easy. No problem in Keene. I know plenty of people who have done it. I know plenty of people who have worked for Walmart for near close to minimum wage, you know, $25,000 a year. And they own houses, you know, they own houses, they own apartments, they own condos. You know, this idea, you know, that minimum wage or something close to minimum wage you can't live on in the United States is ridiculous. It absolutely is something you can, and I'm talking about the national minimum wage. And if you can't afford to live on it, you've got issues that have nothing to do with minimum wage. You know, sometimes you have to take responsibility for yourself, and some people don't. And obviously there's going to be, you know, some percentage of the population who, you know, there's nothing they can do. You know, they've got medications, or they've got, you know, they've got some problem through, you know, that's not self-induced, right? Let's put it that way. And I'm not talking about those people. I'm not talking about those people at all. Obviously, you know, if your drugs are $900 a month and, you know, you make minimum wage, you probably got yourself a problem there. And it's not going to be solved probably by, I mean, maybe you could get out of that by, you know, I don't know, getting an education and making more money or something like that. But yeah. All right. Let's see here. I'm going to read this one little section here. The regulator in China caused Bitcoin prices to plunge last month when it banned banks and payment firms from offering clients any services involving cryptocurrencies, and warned of the risk linked to trading in crypto assets. And yeah, and here's the other thing. It's like, okay, so let me get this straight. So the banks basically and governments caused Bitcoin to fall in value, and then you're blaming Bitcoin for falling in value and saying, well, you have to have 100% of your, you know, crypto backed by dollars in case it collapses, but you're the one causing the collapse. Like, seems like even more of a reason to move your assets from, you know, dirty fiat currencies to cryptocurrencies. And, you know, I do want to point out that crypto is, crypto has some similarities to dirty fiat currencies. They're not quite as bad, I don't think, because it's sort of a little bit better. Like, it's more like gold in some respects, where there's not, like, at least with like Bitcoin, where there's not going to be more than 21 million Bitcoin ever. And what they're minting, we know what they're minting and how much new Bitcoin is coming into the market. And it's not a secret, right? You don't know what the U.S. government's going to print in terms of dollars next year. We know that they're going to print a lot of dollars. They did this year anyway, let's put it that way, and they pretty much always have. Maybe not as much as they did this year, but they certainly have been in recent years printing a heck of a lot of dollars. You know, between 2005 and actually probably since 2000, they've been doing a lot of stuff that is effectively printing dollars or something akin to that. Because again, remember, there's different ways that they kind of manipulate us, right? You know, some of those ways might be like unloading gold right onto the market and then claiming that gold as if they had it when they don't have it to back the dollar, or something of that nature. So all right, let's move on. Let's see what else we got here. So I got some interesting. I watched a video from, let's see, what was it? It was the Bitcoin conference in Miami that occurred, and they got an interview with Ross, effectively, where they got a talk out of him, effectively. And for those who are not familiar with Ross Ulbricht, he basically was the guy behind Silk Road. And, well, let's put it this way. The government basically did a lot of bad stuff, and he's being held in a high security prison, as I understand it. And in that high security prison, they have this thing called the hole. Well, when you speak out against government, which arguably he was doing prior to his incarceration, but certainly has been censored while in the cage, he has recently come out and he gave a speech, and the government didn't like that. So he is currently again in the hole. It's not the first time he's been in the hole. Apparently they held him in the hole for 4 months on prior occasions. I don't know for what reason exactly, you know, what excuse they made, but basically the hole is a way for the U.S. government to, what I would say is torturing, you know, torture political prisoners, mostly people who they don't like, people who say things that, you know, the government doesn't want them to say. And basically you're put into a small box, and there's they give you food and they give you, I don't even know, but basically you don't have anything. You're no books, nothing. And that's it, you know, for months on end, and sometimes years on end, you know. And effectively this is what they did to Ross, and they've done it to many other political prisoners. So that's apparently what they've done in this case with his recent speech, even though his speech didn't really say anything that seems like it would be prohibited even. But nonetheless, they did, because they don't want him speaking to the public, because he is effectively a leader in our community, even behind bars. So here's a tweet that I'm just going to read this little tweet here. That was, and it's humorous because he actually speaks about the whole in his speech. And I would encourage people to check it out, search for Bitcoin Ross, talk or something like that, and you'll come up with it. It's, it was this week. So it was like June 12th, 2021. You should be able to find it for this roughly sometime this week or this month or something like that. It was definitely within the last month. Ross has been put into the SHU, aka The Hole, after a recorded interview he did over the phone with Bitcoin Magazine was broadcasted at the Bitcoin Conf this weekend. So, yeah. If you didn't think the U.S. government was persecuting people, well, you're just simply wrong. All right. Let's see what else we got here. FinanceYahoo.com reports China arrests over 1,100 suspects in crackdown on crypto-related money laundering. Oh, no. Police in China arrested over 1,100 people suspected of using cryptocurrencies to launder illegal proceeds from telephone and internet scams in a recent crackdown, the Ministry of Public Security said. The arrests come as authorities in China step up their crackdown on cryptocurrency trading. Last month, three industry bodies banned crypto-related financial and payment services, and the State Council, China's cabinet, vowed to clamp down on Bitcoin mining and trading. The Public Security Ministry said that by Wednesday afternoon, police had busted more than 170 criminal groups involved in using cryptocurrencies to launder money. You know, it's kind of humorous what they consider to constitute like laundering money. It's such crap, you know. Effectively buying and selling cryptocurrency, they consider to be money laundering, right? It's not necessarily like hiding, you know, criminal activity or anything, or like anything legitimate, like it's not harming anybody effectively. You know, they want to give this impression that money launderers are like, you know, covering up the crimes of murderers and drug traffickers and all sorts of things. But the reality is, you know, just about any one of us could be charged with a money laundering based on the law and how broad it is. Have you been to the bank three times this week? You're a money launderer. It's that level of ridiculous. The money launderers charged their criminal clients a commission of 1.5 to 5% to convert. Yeah. And this is the thing that is ridiculously low. In terms of like a commission, this is very obviously just people selling cryptocurrency based on one of these numbers. Actual like people who are laundering money for the proceeds, you know, like to hide the proceeds of crime, they don't charge 1.5 to 5%. They'll take like a 25% cut or more maybe. So this is not what you would think. This is not money laundering for like criminal to hide criminal proceeds as they're suggesting. The money launderers charge their criminal clients a commission of 1.5 to 5% to convert illegal proceeds into virtual currencies. See, this is the thing. They're saying illegal proceeds, but I don't believe this. It's more than likely proceeds into virtual currencies. Whether or not they're illegal is, you know, going to be debatable, and it's going to be, you know, dependent on the individual case. But I can tell you that the vast majority of dollars that get converted into cryptocurrencies are not from illegal proceeds. They're from people wanting to, in some sense, I would say, unfortunately, invest in cryptocurrencies. It's not to convert dollars or, you know, yang or whatever into that are somehow earned from illegal businesses into cryptocurrencies. You could just accept it if you want to. If you're an illegal operation, you could just accept the cryptocurrencies. You don't need to convert it. Anyway, convert illegal proceeds into virtual currencies via crypto exchanges, the ministry said via its official WeChat account. Yeah, I mean, so they are literally saying they're basically criminalizing exchanges. So it's illegal to accept dirty fiat, the government's currency, right, for crypto and give somebody else crypto. That's effectively what they're doing. They're trying to crack down on people selling their Bitcoin for dollars or for yen or whatever China's currency is. China's Payment and Clearing Association said on Wednesday that the number of crimes involving the use, and this is now more fear-mongering, crimes involving the use of virtual currencies is on the rise. So let me remind people again that dirty fiat, you know, government currencies are the leading tool for basically laundering money, and the banking systems, the government regulated banks launder more money, okay, than cryptocurrency does. Like it's not even a tiny fraction of what the government itself launders. I mean, this idea that like, I mean, are you really suggesting that we like outlaw dollars? Is that where we're going? I mean, this is ridiculous. If you there's not a whole lot that you can do with crypto that you can't do with dollars. The only difference is it makes it easier to basically do business in that you don't have to physically transport the item from one place to another. That's that's a killer feature. And it also does save money in the sense of, like, in terms of transaction fees. I don't know if anybody has tried to deposit a large amount of money here recently, but banks are now charging you 8%. So if you say you saved up $5,000, right, and you go to the bank and you deposit $5,000 in cash, they're going to charge you. They're going to charge you for that. So if you go and do a wire transfer, let's say you need to move that money from one location to another location, again, you might pay. I mean, it depends on how you do it and various other factors, but you might pay $100 for that. You might pay more if it's like overseas or something like that. You know, if you take a credit card as a business, you know, you could pay $70-$100 maybe on $1,000 transaction, in credit card fees. Right. So, you know, this idea that, you know, cryptocurrencies, they have value, but they're not necessarily like, it's not value in the sense that it hides anything, right? The blockchain, at least with Bitcoins, there's nothing secret about it. It's public. Anybody can go and look and follow the transactions that occur on it. They like to, you know, claim it's anonymous, and it's not even really pseudo anonymous. It doesn't require somebody, like, when you open a bank account, you have to provide like a social security number or a passport or something like that usually, right? Now, you don't have to do that to create a wallet, but you also don't have to do that in order to accept dollars from another person and put it under your bed, right? So this idea that like that you should somehow, like, it should be illegal simply because you don't have to identify to accept it or to, you know, pay somebody with it is just ridiculous. Because cryptocurrencies are anonymous, convenient, and global in nature, they've increasingly become an important channel for cross-border money laundering. No, they probably should. It should be the case, but it's probably an exaggeration that it's definitely not the primary means that drug cartels use to launder money. We already know that just because of the amount of basically drugs that are being sold and moved internationally and the money that's going back and forth, it's so much more than what cryptocurrencies today can even do or handle. Like, it wouldn't work. So that's not how it's happening. Maybe someday, but right now that's not really what's going on. Certainly there have been, there are people buy and sell drugs, you know, with cryptocurrencies, but they also sell, you know, they buy and sell computers with cryptocurrencies. They buy and sell, you know, all sorts of items, food items with cryptocurrencies. I got lunch today at Mighty Moose Mart and I paid with cryptocurrencies, you know. I got a couple chicken sandwiches and some sort of tornado and a Coke and a bunch of snack items as well. And, you know, so I bought a bunch of stuff. You know, there's all sorts of things that people buy with cryptocurrencies, and most of them are not illegal. Most of the stuff that happens in the crypto world isn't even, it's not drug related. It's not criminal, you know, criminally motivated. Now, you might be making people into criminals by, you know, criminalizing it or making it absolutely insane the way you're supposed to account for it or something like that. But as far as, like, you know, people doing something that's harming another individual, probably nobody or almost nobody is doing that, or using cryptocurrencies in the process of doing that. And I say almost nobody because it's almost nobody probably for, you know, US dollars as well. And again, harm is the key word here. So there's a difference between crime and harm, right? So yeah, sure, there's a lot of people who are, you know, are committing crimes, but they're not necessarily harming anybody. And that's the key thing here. When you make everybody a criminal, that doesn't mean everybody's harming somebody. And that's effectively what the government has done. They've made everybody a criminal. And, you know, you might not realize it, but you're a criminal if you're listening to the show. So, yep. All right. Going on to a next story here. The last American Vagabond.com is reporting lawsuit accuses digital recognition network of secretly collecting billions of license plates. We're going to get into this, but I'm going to take a quick break here.
We'd like to invite you to visit freekeen.com.
FreeKeen.com features audio, video, and blogs chronicling the transition to a voluntary society. FreeKeen.com also has comments and discussion forums so you can be heard. FreeKeen.com.
I should be in Keene, New Hampshire with the Free Staters.
If you haven't shopped at libertyminded.com, you're missing out. The company's got lots of great t-shirts, such as voting outside of a two-party system is a wasted vote because the candidate will not win, because voting outside of the two-party system is a wasted vote because the candidate will not win, because voting outside, I think you get the idea. Talk about circular reasoning. Did you know that Fedora the Explorer, exploring free software one distro at a time, is one of my favorite t-shirts? It's a great t-shirt for any distro hoppers in your life. Liberty Minded has lots of great t-shirts like this and many others. How about, I was reported to the FBI, but they just ignored it? Or, no, you can't be my friend. I'm not on Facebook. Which may or may not really be related. Now this is one that all hackers can agree on. Intellectual property is really information slavery. Information just wants to be free. And if the last one was too wordy, how about intellectual property is neither? Join liberty-minded voluntarists, anarchists, and libertarians this summer from June 13th until June 18th for ForkFest 2019 at Rogers Campground in the beautiful White Mountains of New Hampshire. ForkFest happens right before the Porcupine Freedom Festival, and ForkFest is decentralized, which means no one is in charge. That also means there's no ticket cost. Just reserve your camping or RV site or motel room with Rogers Campground for June 13th through June 18th. You can simply relax and go camping with other liberty lovers, or you can create whatever experience or event you'd like others to have. If you're planning an event for ForkFest, be sure to let others know in advance. You can connect with other ForkFesters via the unofficial Telegram chat or the ForkFest forum. Links to those are on the unofficial website, forkfest.party.
Streaming live from our Keene, New Hampshire studios, you are listening to Freedom Decrypted. All right, so we are going to go back to our story here. So let's see here. On May 26th, several vehicle owners sued the company Digital Recognition Network for using its fleet of unmarked surveillance vehicles to collect data on Americans. The plaintiffs claim that DRN has driven its vehicles around the United States and covertly gathered data on unsuspecting Americans while reaping profits. So, yeah, they're basically collecting vehicle data on millions of Americans, and I don't want to go into the story really too much, to be honest. I just want to make some comments on it. So basically, this is the problem that I have with driver's licenses and license plates and vehicle registration and all that. And, like, you know, it's basically, it enables tracking, and I would definitely not suggest that we should have a system where, I don't know where I'm going with this, so we shouldn't have this, because it's enabling thing. Like, even if you trust the government, do you trust corporations? I don't. Corporations and government are more or less one in the same. They both do really bad shit, right? And you're enabling, yeah, you might be enabling them to track down some vehicles which are stolen, no doubt. But there's also these things called VINs, right? You know, there's both bad and maybe some good, but you also have means of protecting yourself. There are things called GPS devices. There are cellular networks. There are other ways, you know, to keep tabs on your vehicle. A license plate should not be mandatory, because it also means tracking. It also means the bad guys. Whether you think the government's good or bad, it enables the government to track you. It enables criminals to track you. It enables all sorts, all types to track people. And this is just one example of that, right? So how are they using this information? I don't know. But it doesn't really matter. The act of doing it is a problem. I don't think we should ban, you know, filming in public or anything like that. But I do think that there's a certain level of reasonable level of, you know, effectively privacy that people should have when they go out in public. And I think you know, it's one of these things where, and I'm not suggesting that, you know, I'm not suggesting that, you know, it shouldn't be allowed necessarily, but I don't think that the government should be mandating things that enable it effectively, right? So license plates, you shouldn't force people to be able to have, throw a license plate. You shouldn't force them to have license plates on their vehicles. Now, that doesn't mean that people can't necessarily be tracked. There's all sorts of ways to track people, but there are, but it makes it a little bit more difficult, right? Your phone, you can potentially track people based on your phone data, but there's also ways to kind of thwart some of that. So there's this balance, and the balance is definitely in favor of the nefarious actors right now and not you, Joe Public. We should be looking to get rid of these things that are not necessary, and they arguably are way worse than, you know, any benefit, you know, that supposedly exists from their existence in the first place. And there's nothing that stops somebody, you know, there's nothing that stops a cop from pulling somebody over, you know, who's, you know, a danger, right? You can pull a driver over whether or not they have a license plate on their vehicle. So, you know, this whole safety argument is mostly a load of shit. And even back in the day when they were rolling out driver's licenses, for example, it wasn't because of safety. That's what they kind of used later. They justified it with later, but it actually started with, motor vehicles and, effectively a bigotry, a form of bigotry basically against motor vehicle owners. So it was not this thing where, oh, it's a safety thing. It's a, we don't like people who drive vehicles, because at the time very few people had motor vehicles. Most people had, like, you know, horses and things that they rode on, or they just walked. And so they didn't like the motor vehicle operators, and therefore that's how we ended up with, you know, driver's licenses and license plates and so on. And it was a very bigoted sort of situation. And then over time, you know, they kind of excused it away, you know, with safety. And, but the thing is, if you actually look at the laws, even in the late 60s, you might've had to get a driver's license, but there was no safety component to it. There was no, they were basically like, they were like guns. Basically they were shall issue. So you basically signed up for a driver's license, but you didn't actually have to take a road test. You didn't have to take any kind of written test. It was just, you got yourself a license and that was it. There wasn't a photograph on the license even. There wasn't, you know, there had they had your name basically back in the day. And this is like in my lifetime. And they might've had like a description, like your eye color and your hair color. And I'm trying to think what else was on it. Your height, I think. But that was it, you know? So, you know, and don't, and I'm not suggesting that, you know, there weren't, or that there were like less accidents or, you know, less drunk driving, you know, no. There was more drunk driving, you know, back in the day, and there were more, you know, issues, but that doesn't necessarily mean that was a bad thing, you know, in the scheme of it, because we had more freedom. Right. And there's nothing that says you can't discourage drunk driving without having driver's licenses, right? You don't have to have driver's licenses in order to discourage drunk driving. You don't have to be able to suspend somebody's driver's license or take away somebody's car to discourage drunk driving. You know, you can discourage drunk driving without any of that. So, yeah, I mean, it's the tools that you use to do, you know, to do some of this stuff should not be immoral. You know, you shouldn't be doing one immoral thing to discourage another immoral thing effectively. All right. Let's see here. What else do we got? So we got a story here from Torrent Freak. Record labels sue Frontier for failing to terminate persistent pirates. Over the past several years, there has been a drive to hold U.S.-based ISPs liable for copyright infringement carried out by their customers. Major recording labels have been at the heart of the action, suing Cox Communications, Charter Communications, and RCN for failing to suspend the accounts of customers who pirated music, even though the ISPs had been sent multiple DMCA notices indicating that infringement was taking place. Those lawsuits are a serious business. In Cox Communications' case, a jury ordered the ISP to pay $1 billion in damages. I'm going to repeat that. $1 billion in damages. I mean, talk about ridiculous, right? Like, I understand I understand this idea that, like, okay, you're not doing something correctly. We want you to change that, you know, your processes or something. But why should there be a $1 billion damages award attached to it? I mean, this is ridiculous. They were doing the same thing or more than what every other ISP was doing. Cox is now fighting that decision, warning that if it loses, the internet will never be the same. Yeah, it definitely will not be the same. And, you know, good groups like the EFF and others are fighting, you know, are fighting this ridiculous lawsuit. Actually, I don't think you can say they're fighting it. They are putting in, I'm trying to think what they call those, but they're basically putting in friends of the court or briefs. It's something like friends of the court. Like they're briefs for the friends of the court or by the friends of the court or something like that. And it basically is just an outside opinion saying, hey, this is going to affect a lot of people and you shouldn't do this or that, basically. Undeterred by that possible eventuality yesterday, the same Core Record labels filed a fresh lawsuit against ISP Frontier Communications containing similar allegations and the prospect of a considerable damages award. UMG Recordings Incorporated versus Frontier Communications Corporation, filed in a New York district court yesterday by UMG Recordings Incorporated, Sony Music Entertainment, blah, 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 and a dozen other labels. The lawsuit consists of similar accusations previously leveled again. I already said this more or less. They're just repeating themselves in the story. According to the labels, they sent more than 20,000. 20,000 isn't even that much. Frontier is like, it's a big ISP, at least in the Northeast. According to the labels, together they sent more than 20,000 DMCA copyright notices to Frontier, complaining that its subscribers were unlawfully downloading, copying, and distributing their copyrighted works. Oh no! Using peer-to-peer networks, including BitTorrent. The plaintiffs state that these notices alerted Frontier to clear and unambiguous infringing activity. That's not the case. While also identifying a specific subscribers as flagrant and serial infringers. Well, first of all, you might have a single subscriber, but you don't necessarily have a single user, right? So it's not necessarily clear and unambiguous for multiple different reasons, really, that there is infringing or, you know, a problem here of infringing activity. It's also a substantial problem because there is no real due process for the individuals who have been accused. And there's not even any proof that the subscriber has committed infringement. A user on the network has committed infringement, but it's not necessarily a subscriber. The labels state, and it's only an accusation anyway. So it's not you brought this person to court and they've been convicted of infringement. It's, oh, we're just going to accuse you of infringement and you now have to disconnect somebody. The labels state that over the years, Frontier has also received thousands of infringement notices from other copyright holders, which identified thousands of Frontier subscribers engaged in blatant and repeat infringement. More than 4,000 subscribers were identified in 3 or more notices, and some subscribers identified in 100 notices or more. Well, yeah, I mean, if you're a hosting company, you might have a lot of infringement going on within your network, right? Because obviously there's a huge difference between a household where there's a subscriber and they've got 5 users on their network and a hosting provider who's a subscriber to an ISP who has thousands or hundreds of thousands of subscribers, right? You're obviously going to get a heck of a lot more notices to the hosting provider that has thousands of people on their network versus the household that has 5 people on their network for their one subscription. These examples and countless others amply illustrate that rather than terminating repeat infringers and losing subscription revenue, Frontier consciously chose to look the other way in order to continue to collect subscriber fees, the complaint reads. Frontier had the ability and obligation to prevent infringement. No, they didn't. Citing Frontier's acceptable use policy, the labels say that Frontier had the power to suspend or terminate subscribers' internet access for a variety of reasons, including for transmitting or receiving copyright infringing material. The AUP also addresses the issues of repeat infringement notices, noting that this process grounds for termination of service. Yeah, I mean, the problem is this is just a mere accusation and not proof. So it's, yeah, that just because they can terminate doesn't mean that, you know, if a court orders it, for example, or something like that. All right. Let's see here. Keep going down. Where is it? Well, here it's here. Blah, blah, blah. Where does it say? All right. These examples and countless others amply illustrate that rather than terminating repeat infringers and losing subscription revenue, Frontier consciously chose to look the other way in order to continue to collect subscriber fees, the complaint reads. Frontier had the ability and obligation to prevent infringement. Citing Frontier's acceptable use policy, the labels say that Frontier had the power to suspend or terminate a subscriber's internet access for a variety of reasons, including for transmitting or receiving copyright infringing material. The AUP also addresses the issue of repeat infringement, noting that this provides grounds for termination of service. Despite these alleged policies, and despite receiving thousands of DMCA notices from plaintiffs' representatives and thousands of similar notices from other copyright owners, Frontier knowingly permitted specifically identified repeat infringers to continue to use it's no it's again they're merely allegations. They did not have knowledge of they merely had knowledge that you sent them a notice of infringement, not that there was actual infringement, to continue to use its network to infringe, the complaint adds. There's no evidence here. I merely accusing somebody is not evidence of a crime. Holding Frontier liable for contributing to the direct infringements of its customers. Again, there's no evidence of direct infringement of its customers. The labels say that the ISP was motivated to keep infringing subscribers on board for financial benefit, adding that terminating subscribers would deprive it of revenue and make its service less attractive to existing prospective customers. Ridiculous. Are you telling me that if somebody was unable to infringe, that they would not be subscribing to an ISP? I mean, the internet is more than just pirating your materials. Copyright infringing materials. There's this thing called email, and there's legal outlets like YouTube, and there's just all sorts of, and like your very own streaming services that are like authorized and not copyright infringing. There are many different uses for the internet in terms of communication, and your content is just one of many. Since peer-to-peer use consumes lots of data, oh my God, this is such a ridiculous argument. Lots of data usage, infringing customers were particularly lucrative. I mean, okay, first of all, there is no benefit, you know, financial benefit from somebody who downloads Linux ISOs than from somebody who, you know, is infringing. And you can do one or neither of those things, and you can still have or want and desire a fast internet connection. Like this idea that it's only going to be beneficial or mostly beneficial to people with who are pirating is absurd. The plaintiff said, pirates are likely to pay more money for faster connections. Yeah, and so is every other type of user. If people can afford it, they'll pay more in order to get a faster connection with greater usage limits. Yeah, but the thing is, it doesn't matter whether or not you are on a 1.5 megabit per second connection or a gigabit per second connection. You can copy and pirate stuff either way. It just takes longer, right? You know, people were pirating stuff back in the days of dial-up modems. This idea that like you can't pirate just because you have a slower internet connection is ridiculous, or it somehow limits your ability to pirate. No, it just takes longer. Leading Frontier to turn a blind eye to repeat infringement by known specific subscribers. It's probably not the case that there is a difference in statistics between people who have faster connections in terms of piracy and those who do not. Outside that, it might be the case that people who are more sophisticated have faster connections, which might mean they're also more capable of pirating. So, but I'm doubtful that there's that big of a number, because the ISPs, the way they sell it, people who are not sophisticated users also have fast internet connections. So I suspect my gut feeling is that there's probably not a difference in like piracy rates between people with lower tier connections and the people with higher tier connections, but I would love to see some data on that. The specific infringing subscribers identified the DMCA notices knew Frontier would not terminate their accounts despite receiving multiple notices and identifying them as infringers, and they remained Frontier subscribers to continue illegally downloading copyrighted works, the complaint notes. Yeah, I mean, here's the other problem with this argument. Like, every single time you, like, visit a webpage, you're effectively pirating that webpage. At least when it comes to like situations where there is comments, like for example at the bottom, because that is effectively a copyright. You know, the person who posted it owns a copyright. Now, I know some people are going to say, yeah, but if you read the policy of the site or whatever, those are, you know, they give up their rights to copyright or something like that. But not every site is like that, right? So there is copyright. There is nonstop copyright infringement like every day by every person who goes on the internet. Contributory and vicarious copyright infringement. The complaint lists 2,856 copyrighted works owned by the labels, including tracks by Tupac, 50 Cent. I'm not going to go through the list of them all. That's just ridiculous. These were all illegally reproduced and distributed by Frontier customers via BitTorrent and other peer-to-peer protocols in breach of the label's copyrights. I mean, this is like saying that the post office should be liable for somebody who sends a pirated CD through the mail. I mean, this is ridiculous. You should cut off their mail. You know, the post office shouldn't deliver to this individual anymore because they sent a pirated CD through the mail. I mean, come on. The lawsuit claims that Frontier's failure to take action against repeat infringers dates back to 2013, but the labels are only interested in narrowly defined blah, 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 period. Let's see here. Blah, blah, blah. Let's see here. Yeah, I mean, they're basically, we don't really care about any of this. Yeah, I mean, they're being basically, they're claiming the copyright cartels are claiming that they are purposefully ignoring and turning a blind eye to its subscribers' flagrant and repeated infringements. Frontier knowingly caused a material contributed to the unlawful reproduction and distribution of plaintiffs' copyrighted works. They're claiming a ton of money. They want billions of dollars, blah, blah, blah. All right. They want some sort of injunction against them. I mean, they want a trial by jury because they can, you know, manipulate it. See here. This is interesting. A statement from Frontier Communications spokesperson. Frontier is not alleged to have done anything directly to infringe any copyright owner's rights and, in fact, has terminated many customers about whom copyright owners have complained. That's interesting because that's more than Cox, I believe, did. Frontier believes that it has done nothing wrong and will vigorously defend itself. So it'll be interesting if they're successful against Frontier, in spite of the fact that they have terminated customers, unlike I believe Cox, part of the problem was they did not terminate anybody, they also claim that they allowed them to resubscribe, so I'm not sure, but you do have to wonder. I mean, technically they had a policy. If they terminated customers, they followed that policy and they complied with the law. Now, the fact that customers sign back up for service, it doesn't say they can't. It doesn't say in the law that they can't sign back up for service. I mean, this is one of these things where it's like they wrote this broad and unclear law and now they're fighting it for year after year after year. And this shouldn't even be allowed. You know, this is a stifle on freedom of speech and it should be constitutionally protected. It should be have a greater constitutional protection. Copyright is authorized by the Constitution, but it doesn't mandate it, right? It simply allows it. Freedom of speech is very, very clearly in the Constitution, right? In and of itself. Okay. You know, something that is in the Constitution as opposed to just permitting there to be a law is very, very clear to me that that's a higher degree of protection. And so these copyright laws should be mostly null and void. All right. Twitter restricts accounts in India to comply with government's legal request. TechCrunch.com. So this is a censorship story. This is the clearest censorship story I think that I've done in a while. Twitter disclosed on Monday that it blocked 4 accounts in India to comply with a new legal request from the Indian government. The American Social Network disclosed on Lumen Database, a Harvard University project, that it took action on 4 accounts, including those of hip-hop artist El Fresh, The Lion, and singer and songwriter Jazzy B, to comply with a legal request from the Indian government it received over the weekend. The accounts are geo-restricted within India, but accessible from outside the South Asian nation. All right. See, all 4 accounts, like several others that the Indian government ordered to be blocked in the country earlier this year, had tested New Delphi's agriculture reforms, and some had posted other tweets that criticized Prime Minister 7 years of governance in India. An analysis by TechCrunch found. Yeah, I mean, so basically, I don't want to get into this story too much. Basically, this is more Indian censorship. Like, it's outright censor. It's like there's no argument. Like, there's no arguing about this. Like, was this censorship? Was this not censorship? It is censorship. It's effectively going after somebody for saying something that the government doesn't like. It's so blatant, and India is really bad. I don't know what it is with India, but India is just like, their government is so messed up in so many ways. It's so backwards. Like, try mailing something to India sometime. You know, it, chances are it's not going to get there. Try, try saying something in India that the government doesn't want you to say. I mean, look at what happens. This is what happens. It's not like an India specific problem. It happens even in the United States, but it's like India is just like on the extreme end of it, basically. And it's kind of weird because like India is supposed to be this like democratic, you know, country, and yet there is no accountability. I mean, there's not much accountability in the United States, but there's even less accountability in India. You know, it's just terrible. It is terrible. I would not want to live in India. All right. TorrentFreak.com reports, why is Verizon blocking pirate sites? So apparently Verizon is blocking pirate sites. For more than a week, Verizon customers have been unable to access several popular pirate sites. The IP addresses of sites such as NYAA and Mangadex are null routed instead. While the blocks appear to be intentional, Verizon is keeping its motivation quiet. So why are these sites blocked? And has it got anything to do with piracy? Could it be related to Russian CDN provider DDoS Guard, which the sites have in common? A week ago, complaints started pouring in that Verizon is actively blocking pirate sites. The issue was widely discussed on social media as well, where some suggested the pirate site blocking has officially arrived in the US. At first glance, it indeed seems this way. Popular sites such as NYAA and Megadex are unreachable. The same applies to Kemono.party and many others. Users who try to access the sites get an error message in their browsers instead, noting that the domain names are unreachable. The big question is why these domains are being blocked. Not a simple error. To find out more, we reached out to Verizon through official channels, official press channels last week, but without any response. That's not uncommon, really. That leaves us with no other option than simply report what we know and what this could potentially mean. At this point, it's clear that Verizon has known about the issue for over a week, aside from reaching out ourselves. Yeah, so I mean, basically, if it was a mere simple error, they would have resolved it by now, that at least by the point in which the story had come out. So the block sites we know of have things in common in that they're all pirate sites. Yeah, so I mean, sounds like basically Verizon is blocking I'm trying to think what they call these, a CDN, content delivery network, and basically a lot of sites that use that content delivery network, and thus there's going to be overblocking that results as well, and that's likely why it's not just one particular pirate site, but it's many different pirate sites. And DDS Guard apparently is known for hosting a lot of pirate sites, I guess, and Cloudflare does too, though, so it's kind of interesting. But what that means also is that there's probably non-pirate sites that are also blocked. Let's see here. So apparently DDoS Guard is not responsive to takedown requests. So that's interesting. Let's see here. In addition, pirate sites, scammers, spammers, and other types also blah, 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 take and use DDoS Guard. Let's see here. Piracy block or collateral damage. Let's see here. So they have similar but different DDoS Guard IP addresses. All right. So there are some similarities between at least these two sites that have been blocked. Let's see here. Yep, so they're basically black holing it. That's what it means to be null routed. One of them apparently is a phishing site. And let's see. So It might be piracy related. It might not be. And Verizon apparently is not being clear about it. So they're not revealing what the reason is at this point. Let's see, it's certainly possible that the NYAA and Megadex IP addresses are being blocked due to collateral damage because other sites or services are using those IPs for nefarious purposes. Large network providers regularly block malicious IP addresses, so that wouldn't be unusual. That's disturbing to me that they would block malicious IP addresses. That should be for the user to decide, not for the ISP to decide. The ISP should be blind in that regard, I think. And I've always been very annoyed by ISPs who do that sort of thing, you know, whether it comes to blocking ports or blocking, you know, I mean, that's, I understand that, like, you know, you got to manage your email servers and stuff, and people are annoyed by spam and things like that. But I don't agree philosophically. I think, you know, you've agreed to receive what you've agreed to receive. Like, it's supposed to be this neutral system. And when you start, you know, censoring, it sets a very, very bad precedent. All right, let's see here. Not a typical pirate site block. So Verizon's Looking Glass reveals that in North America, the blocked IP addresses are null routed to AS655512. This essentially means that all traffic goes into a black hole. Right. I mean, this is typical way to handle abuse. This is certainly not how other ISPs block pirate sites. Yeah, that's for sure. Usually it's like based on DNS or simply something of that nature. Let's see here. Is there anything else worth mentioning? Let's see here. History of unintentional pirate site blocking. This isn't the first time the pirate sites have found themselves mysteriously blocked. A few years ago, Cogent suddenly blocked several Cloudflare IP addresses that were linked to the Pirate Bay and other pirate sites. Cogent's blockade was eventually linked to a court order, which required the internet backbone provider to block, and that's scary, the internet backbone provider to block several IP addresses. Many of the pirate sites subsequently went down as collateral damage. Right, because it's not just one site that goes down. You will potentially knock out lots of other sites, especially depending on how the infrastructure is set up. Comcast also has a history of unintentional blocking. I mean, this idea that a government can simply block content, that's speech. You're blocking speech. 10 years ago, the ISP's users were unable to access the Pirate Bay. However, the company swiftly reached out to the Pirate Bay and resolved the issue within hours after it became public. Verizon has the answers. To us, it seems unlikely that Verizon has unilaterally started blocking pirate sites that all happened to use DDoS guard without a court order, but it's possible. Or perhaps there is a court order. Verizon is the only one with the answers here, but for now, the company is silent. Yep. So hopefully we find out what's going on, and I suspect there probably is a court order here of some kind, and it is just, that's my gut suspicion. I mean, the US ISPs are not huge on censorship, you know, when it comes to censorship like other countries. There's not this same level of like mandatory censorship, so there's not like these filters like there are in a lot of other countries. So when the US wants you, they'll go after you wherever you are. That's what it comes down to. Oh, we don't have cooperation with North Korea. We'll just send in a drone and kill you. All right. RT.com is reporting 800 plus suspects arrested in exceptional global sting operation where gangs were lured into using monitored chat app. I'm guessing they're trying to say says Europol or Europol or something. All right, let's see here. Let's see if I can get this at a manageable ability for me to both see and read, and at the same time, not too big. Hundreds of suspects were apprehended in various countries during the Operation Trojan Shield Greenlight, a sting which had criminal syndicates using a chat monitored by the FBI, Europol said. The FBI, in cooperation with Australian police, has been secretly operating encrypted chat app Anom, which was popular among criminal gangs. Yeah, I have not heard of this app, but when you're using proprietary software, which I'm pretty sure this was, that should be a red flag. When you're using non-standard protocols, that should be a red flag. There are or algorithms, like encryption algorithms, I guess is more along what I was getting at there. So yeah, I mean, it's like, it's one of these things where it's like, look, it's the source code in and of itself is not security. However, you can't start talking about security without having source code. And, that should have been, that's one of the reasons why this should have been like a huge red flag right here. The criminals had no idea that they were being surveilled while using the app. The covert operation eventually evolved into a joint effort by 16 countries to crack down on organized crime. More than 12,000 mobile phones with the app were used by over 300 criminal syndicates, including Italian mafias across roughly 100 nations. Europol said in a statement on Tuesday, the operations resulted in the arrest of more than 800 suspects. Police seized 250 firearms, 55 luxury cars, tons of various drugs, including cocaine, cannabis, and MDMA were also confiscated, as well as over $48 million in different currencies and cryptocurrencies. I love it how they said how cryptocurrencies were part of this seizure. Europol Deputy Executive Director said the takedown was exceptional by its global outcomes. To date, 155 people have been detained in Sweden, the country's police said. Linda Staff, the head of intelligence at the Swedish police authority, said that many suspects were linked to the drug market. She added that five Swedish criminal actors were arrested in Spain. Using the information obtained from the app, Swedish police prevented more than 10 planned murders, Staff said. She hailed the operation as one of the most extensive strikes. I wonder how many people they killed in the operation, though, right? Like, you always hear about, like, oh, how they took down all these bad drug dealers, and it's like, all right, I mean, here's the deal. I mean, when you force people into a situation where they're reliant on, like, murder effectively to do business, that's what you're gonna get. When you legalize something and they're not dependent on, you know, murder, you don't get as many murders. The government's literally creating the problem and then like saying, oh, we solved the problem, but we saved 10 lives. Well, you also were the reason for the problem in the first place against violent crime and drug trafficking. You know, there's a lot of murderers that and they're called law enforcement officers as well. Janie van den Berg, the chief constable of the national unit within the Dutch National Police, noted that outlaws were susceptible to ANOM because the app enjoyed a good reputation among criminals and was known for its absolute reliability. But nothing was further from the truth, she said, describing how criminals communicated in 45 languages about armed robberies. Here's the thing. You shouldn't be communicating about these sorts of things on your phone. I mean, the phones are bugged. The most you should be doing is communicating that you want to, you know, meet up with somebody, all right? Not that you want to kill somebody. I mean, this is just, you have to wonder, you know, there's this thing called operational security. And yeah, I understand that you're going to need to communicate some things. There's going to be some things you need to communicate that are not like illegal and criminal. And sure, not a problem. Use your encrypted apps. But at a certain level, you probably shouldn't be communicating, you know, those or having those conversations on an encrypted app because you can't trust it at the end of the day. All right. About armed robberies, assassinations, and the trafficking of drugs, arms, and explosives. Van den Berg said the Dutch police arrested 49 suspects and busted 25 drug labs and storages. The only people here that seem to be committing a, I shouldn't say anybody. I mean, I don't know. I guess maybe they did sort of get some bad people, but it's like you're also part of the problem because you are committing kidnapping and robbery and, I probably murder here as well, but I don't actually know, you know, in this particular case, by going after these individuals, because clearly not all of them are, you know, murderers. You know, some of them may be murderers, but certainly not all of them. All right. Yeah, I mean, there's basically a bunch of different. So it's a world operation, which doesn't seem to be all that unusual these days. Over 100 threats were Threats to life were mitigated thanks to the agents spying on criminals through the app. Shiver said the FBI was able to track the photos of cocaine that was hidden in shipments of fruit and canned goods, among other things. Yeah, I mean, the crazy thing is, it's like they're bragging about like the cooperation of international law enforcement and what can be accomplished, but at the same time, it's like you're not even keeping up with the gangs, international gangs. Australian police earlier reported that 224 suspects were arrested across the country, where the Anom surveillance was known as Operation Ironside. Separately, 35 people were arrested by the New Zealand police. All right. Let's see here. What else we got this week? Long overdue. Here we go. Here's a story by Aria Demezio at freetalklive.com. Well, it's been nearly 3 months since the raid on the FBI, a raid on the Free Talk Live studio by the FBI. And as you might imagine, we've all been pretty busy. Until very recently, Ian Freeman was still detained. Nobody, also known as Rich Paul, remains in detention with a hearing pending. Ian is now free, but under the very tight restrictions. In fact, all of the Crypto Six are under pretty tight restrictions, although luckily the restrictions on myself seem to be the least limiting. Yeah, it's interesting the difference between like Ian and Aria's restrictions. Aria seems to be on a whitelist as far as what website she can visit, but she is free to leave the house and do pretty much what she wants. Whereas Ian is not free to leave the house, but can go to any website that he wants, except for like a couple of crypto websites. So he's got like a blacklist basically. And Ian does have a larger blacklist of people that he's not allowed to communicate with than Aria too. But the whole thing is interesting. It's kind of like they moved Ian from one cage to another. But it's, yeah, the whole thing is very weird, but there is a motion to basically allow Aria and Ian to talk in regards to Free Talk Live, because that's the business and that's a legal business, and that she was employed by, I believe, the church, I'm guessing, here, and thus she should be able to talk to, because she's also mandated to maintain the job that she has, basically. So my supervisory officer has proven to be very fair. Free Talk Live was back to operating in some sort of normal capacity. She's talking about the day of the raid. But then Ian was released and everything crashed. Oh, right. Yeah, sort of. The terms of release prohibit Ian and I have from having contact with one another. Seeing as we're both become critical to the back end of the Free Talk Live, you can imagine how this made things difficult. Yeah, it's kind of humorous. Like, on the one hand, that's a true statement. On the other hand, we did manage to keep it going even without you two, and even with you two in a cage. Or, well, I guess Aria was released right away, so she wasn't in the cage. Oh yeah. So okay. So actually, she was part of what helped us, I think, get the studio back up and running again. So, she just wasn't able to actually co-host during for a while. Okay. So, all right. While we have filed motions to amend these conditions, because it's silly for my conditions to demand me to maintain employment while prohibiting me from having contact with my employer, it is a slow process. Mark also is not allowed contact with Ian. So Mark, it's basically Mark and Ian's show, more or less. I mean, there's a lot of co-hosts, but Mark and Ian basically started the show. Let's put it that way. And it's, I want to say mostly Ian's baby, but Mark is it's both of theirs, I guess, but it's like, they started the show way back in Florida 15 years ago, something like that. And, so Mark has been heavily involved in it, and he's the sales guy basically for Free Talk Live as far as like advertisers and things like that. That's Mark's main involvement in Free Talk Live. He also does co-host once in a I want to say once in a while. When he's here, he co-hosts more, basically. And then Ian co-hosts like 6 days a week normally, six, sometimes 7 days a week. It kind of depends a little bit, but obviously he hasn't been doing that for a couple of months, but he was doing like 6 or 7 days a week for a long time. So Mark also is not allowed contact with Ian. So the only solution before us was to build a second broadcast studio. So that is what I did. Free Talk Live will still be at the Porcupine Freedom Festival and at ForkFest. In fact, yeah, if you haven't gotten a campsite for ForkFest yet, definitely check out ForkFest.party. It's going to be a blast. The Porcupine Freedom Festival is already sold out as far as tickets and campsites go. You might be able to find somebody to share a campsite with still if they've already got a campsite. And possibly even buy tickets, but they're, I don't want to say it's black market, but it's like, it's sort of like black market. You're not getting it directly from the Free State Project Incorporated as far as tickets for the Porcupine Freedom Festival. You don't really need a ticket to go to the Porcupine Freedom Festival. You just need a campsite and or motel room and or pay $5 a day to enter the campsite, the campgrounds. You may not be welcome at the FSP Incorporated specific events that are held on the campground, but you are not prohibited from entering the campground, assuming it's like it was last year. And I as far as I know, they didn't rent out the whole campground, but maybe I'm mistaken about that and you do need a ticket to enter the campground, but I don't believe so. I think they've loosened the rules, as I understand it, last year, and they're keeping those loosened rules, and it's just like you have to wear maybe you might have to wear like a wristband in order to show that you are a ticket holder, and then they will give you entrance into, say, the pavilion, for example, where they do talks and things like that, or, you know, into maybe a party. But there's also other events going on at Rogers Campground for the Porcupine Freedom Festival that are not FSP events specifically. And those you can go in, you can hang out and whatever, basically. Some of those events might have their own ticket as well. So, but if you check out, if you go to the ForkFest.party, join the ForkFest Telegram group and you can get more information there. There's also a mailing list. There's not a whole lot that goes on when it comes to the mailing list at this point. It's mostly just like, oh, ForkFest is coming up. Don't forget to buy your ticket. And if you check out the Telegram ForkFest group, you'll definitely get more information on, you know, how to attend ForkFest. There's another group for the Porcupine Freedom Festival, but they're back to back with each other. So I probably would just go to ForkFest at this point. I mean, there's probably gonna be at least 1,000 people at ForkFest, if not way more than that. There were 2,500 Porcupine Freedom Festival tickets sold this year. So it's going to be a lot of people, and there is a relationship between the two events. So you can kind of guesstimate how many, you know, tickets there might be, or how many people might be going to the ForkFest based just on the ticket sales of the Porcupine Freedom Festival. Because unlike the Porcupine Freedom Festival, ForkFest is a decentralized event where there's nobody in charge. There's nobody organizing it. It just kind of happens. And as a result, there's lots of events that go on. There's a lot to do, but there's no central planning of any of it. So there might be an event where you need a ticket at ForkFest, but that's not like the name itself isn't even official. It has gone by Bandcamp. It's gone by, or it goes by Somalia Fest. There's actually a Somalia Fest room, but that's actually not. It's related, but it's actually not intended to be like, oh, we're going to call it Somalia Fest. It just happened to be the room that is like even less. It's basically an uncensored room for people who are going to ForkFest and other libertarians in the community to go when they're effectively off topic. So if you're not talking about ForkFest, it's not really appropriate to talk about non-Forkfest stuff in the Forkfest Telegram room. Yeah, you can get away with it more so than in the Porcupine Freedom Fest room, because Dennis is, you know, more, there's a bunch more people in there too. So there's a lot of people in the Forkfest room, actually. There's a couple hundred of them, but there's like 400, I think, in the Porcupine Freedom Festival room, and therefore he's much more on top of saying, hey, take it somewhere else. And we actually led the way with, you know, take it somewhere else, and we created a room for people to go somewhere else. So it's a good way of basically not having to censor people, but at the same time enabling conversations to continue going on. So and in the Somalia Fest room, there's no censorship. I mean, it's you can say whatever you want. In fact, it's so lenient that people go in that room who are not libertarian and they troll, basically. And it's pretty much just one guy, because let's be honest, I mean, most of the people, you know, who are in these rooms, you know, they support what's going on. And the trolling is there is a limit, and but we've tried not to even kick people who are trolling. So you can get if anybody annoys you, you'll know who I'm talking about. It's just one guy. Anyway, just ignore it, basically. Let's see here. The government has ripped apart friendships here, and the only one that has a chance of being bridged is the one between Ian and myself. Well, temporarily, at least. I'm pretty sure you guys are all going to remain friends, even if you are not allowed to ever talk to each other again, solely because my role in Free Talk Live. I miss the rest of my friends, though, and I'm sure they miss their friends too. Yeah. I'm not really sure. I'm not really here to wax at length about that, but keep in mind, as Free Talk Live carries on, that it isn't just a matter of technical issues. There is a heavy emotional burden on all of us. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's, you know, when people are attacking you, right? You know, when the government's attacking you, it's going to have its effect. I mean, what you need to do is remember that there's a lot of people who support you. There's a lot of people who are your friends. They're going to do whatever they can, you know, to keep you emotionally as healthy as they can, you know. And, you know, the good thing is that everybody is in pretty good spirits, surprisingly good spirits. And, you know, you're always going to have a negative Nancy in the group, you know, but it's like, at the end of the day, it's like, you know, even the negative Nancys sometimes are like, you know, they're still in pretty good spirits. So the support, or your support, sustains us. Knowing we have an army of supporters at our backs is invaluable at this time. So thank you all for your support, love, and kindness. I look forward to seeing you in a few weeks. Peace, love, and liberty, Aria. So, yep. So check out forkfest.party. All that info is still good and valuable, and forkfest.party is the website, and it will link you to things like the Forkfest calendar and the Forkfest mailing list and the Forkfest Telegram room. So apnews.com, Latvian women charged in US with role in cybercrime group. Oh no. A Latvian woman has been charged with developing malicious software used by a cybercrime organization that infected computers worldwide and looted bank accounts of millions of dollars, the Justice Department said Friday. Alla Witt is charged as part of a 47-count indictment with participating in an organization known as the TrickBot Group, which authorities say operated in Russia and several other countries. The group is accused of infecting millions of computers worldwide with the malware targeted at hospitals, schools, government businesses, and other entities. Witt, who authorities say previously lived in Suriname, was arrested in Miami in February. She was arraigned Friday in a federal court in Cleveland, according to the Justice Department. Okay. Let's see here. The prosecution, which the Justice Department says is part of its newly developed ransomware task force, comes as the Biden administration confronts a growing scourge of ransomware attacks that have targeted crucial supply chains, including meat and fuel. The White House, which has also been contending with cyber espionage campaigns aimed at U.S. government agencies, issued a memo this week underscoring that the fight against ransomware is a top priority. These charges serve as a warning to would-be cyber criminals that the Department of Justice, through the Ransomware and Digital Extortion Task Force, and alongside our partners, will use all the tools at our disposal to disrupt the cyber criminal ecosystem. Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco said in a statement, the indictment accuses Witt of participating in a scheme to steal millions of dollars from entities across the world by infecting computers with malware that captured personal information such as credit card numbers and passwords, and gave TrickBot members access to the victim's network. Among the targets identified in the indictment are real estate and law firms, country clubs, public schools, districts, and other companies. Prosecutors say Witt worked as a malware developer for the group, writing code related to ransomware that told victims they need to acquire special software to decrypt their files. She's also accused of providing code that monitored and tracked authorized users of the malware. In October, weeks before the 2020 presidential election, Microsoft announced legal action to disrupt TrickBot in an operation aimed at knocking offline command and control servers. The indictment, which includes multiple other defendants whose names have been blacked out, includes charges of conspiracy to commit computer fraud, aggregate evaded identity theft, and other crimes. It was not immediately clear if Witt had a lawyer. Okay, I'm not really sure why I brought that story in. I don't know. I'm not sure what comments or what I had to think on it. It just was. Yeah, I mean, this is not the way to go about dealing with these problems. But I've said that on the show so many times. It's you know, secure your freaking system. Stop blaming the people who are, you know, acting in bad faith effectively. All right. Let's see here. Carriers agree to start sharing vertical location data for 911 calls. This is from xda-developers.com. Let's see here. What do they got to say? So I don't know if I really want to read the story. I don't want to get into this too much. Basically, this is just telling you they're going to be able to more clearly identify like where you are in a building, as opposed to right now. They don't really know where you are if you're like in a building. They have a general location, a building. But if you're in a skyscraper, well, good luck finding you. You don't know where, you know, they don't know where you are. So this is basically going to provide vertical data so that they can find people in multi-story buildings, which will reduce response times and ultimately save lives. So, yeah. So I think it looks like they were sued for $100,000, or they settled for $100,000. Yeah, each company will pay $100,000 settlement because they didn't hook up to the system fast enough, basically, even though it was COVID and, you know, they put all sorts of restrictions on these companies. So even after they implement this system, it won't be working for a while because, you know, other system, the actual dispatchers have to connect, be able to connect with it, and that software will need to be updated. So I have a story here from Bloomberg about the Colonial Pipeline hack. So hackers breached Colonial Pipeline using compromised password. So the funny thing with this story is that this is the hack that took down the largest fuel pipeline in the U.S. and led to shortages. The funny thing about this is this wasn't even a case of hacking. This is a case of like a password, you know, being compromised effectively, like an old password that because they failed to do even like basic, very rudimentary security. You know, I guess this is the war, you know, if a government, this is why governments are investing money in attacking when it comes to infrastructure, VIA hacking and electronic means, because the infrastructure is not protected at all. They're not doing the security that they do at a physical level, at a technical level, and therefore it's an easy way to attack, you know, another country. So, yep, I guess we're beginning to see just how bad that is, how bad our governments and corporations are at cybersecurity. Hackers gained entry into the networks of Colonial Pipeline Company on April 29th through a virtual private network account, which allowed employees to remotely access the company's computer network. Well, here's a question. Why do you have this network connected to the internet at all, right? Like, there are other ways to connect and create a network. These should be hardened systems that are connected to dedicated lines. And you could still work remotely, but they're not then accessible as long as, you know, the systems are secured properly. They're not then accessible from the internet effectively. Why are they not doing these things? Like, these are some pretty basic things that you can do, and you can remotely administrator and monitor your network and computer at different locations, even, you know, if these systems are in people's homes, right? So that they can, you know, work remotely. There's no reason that today you have to have an employee install a VPN on their personal computer in order for them to remotely connect to your anything, right? You know, this whole idea that you're not going to do security, you know, like in a even a remotely sane way, it's just crazy. So basically, the account was no longer used at the time of the attack, but could still be used to access Colonial's network. So basically, yeah, they didn't disable the VPN account and they were able to connect because they were not on a private network. They were on the internet and government. Stupid. Oh, well, I guess this is not government. This is a private corporation, but still stupid. Let's see here. So the password was found inside a batch of leaked passwords on the dark web. All right. That means a Colonial employee may have used the same password on another account that was previously hacked. Yeah. I mean, they shouldn't even have been using passwords. Let's see here. What else is there? There may still be good reasons to use passwords in certain circumstances, but probably not in this particular type of case. This is not a situation where, you know, you've got an underground organized group of individuals who, if somebody gets busted, you know, they're going to need to add, and even then you don't even need to do the password thing. If you're smart and you set everything up in advance and whatnot, really what you just need is a backup and somebody who has a knowledge of the plan of action should somebody or, you know, a bunch of people get arrested or something like that. All right. Let's see here. Yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna get into this any further. All right, what else do we got here? Let's see, I think we have one more story, and then we're basically out of. Well, I guess we're basically out of time, and we're also out of out of stuff to talk about. I do technically have more stuff, but I'm gonna call it a show. Today doesn't seem to be going that terribly well for me anyway, for whatever reason. So. All right, I got a story here from USAtoday.com. Justice Department withdraws FBI subpoena for USA Today records IDing readers. This is disturbing. The FBI has withdrawn a subpoena demanding records from USA Today that would identify readers of a February story about a Southern Florida shootout that killed two agents and wounded three others. The subpoena issued as part of an investigation seeking to identify a child sexual exploitation offender was withdrawn after investigators found the person through other means, according to a notice the Justice Department sent to the USA Today's attorneys Saturday. I mean, this is disturbing because effectively they are just going on a search and saying, we're going to go. This is like going house to house and searching every single house because somebody might be in one of those houses that the government wants, right? I don't even know, like what goes through these people's heads. You don't have the right to search people's houses when you don't even have a reason to believe that there's a suspect in that house, right? But in this case, they want to like get information on reading material of the users. I mean, talk about how disturbing this is from like a free country kind of standpoint, right? Think about where this goes down the road, right? Like even if it's okay in this, but like, even if it doesn't seem like there's any possible way that this could be used maliciously or, you know, in a bad way here, what happens when it's, you know, a story about, I don't know, guns or something, you know, and the FBI starts attacking people who read a story about guns? Even if you're not a gun enthusiast, you're now going to get attacked because you read a story about guns, right? And that's where this goes if you allow it to continue to occur. So the fact that they dropped it, you know, I don't know. And this is a case where it's like, it's not a good case to like take up to the Supreme Court probably, because it involves, you know, somebody that they were going after who, you know, is obviously not going to be looked very highly on. And so, you know, the government's going to be able to come up with an argument that sounds more reasonable. However, replace that with activist and all of a sudden it becomes really disturbing, right? So, yeah, Charles Tobin, who represents Gannett USA Today's parent company, said the Justice Department's decision to withdraw the subpoena should remind the Biden administration of the importance of an independent press. Yes, an independent press is very important. And a diverse press, ideally, too, because, you know, you shouldn't have just one perspective to be, you know, ideas distributed basically to the public. The government's own guidelines require the FBI to pursue alternative sources before subpoenaing in a newspaper, Tobin said. This is a reminder of why that restraint makes perfect sense. Withdrawal of the subpoena came on the same day that the Justice Department announced it will no longer secretly obtain reporters' records during leak investigations, a departure from a policy used by previous administrations to try to identify sources who provided journalists with classified information. The reversal came after recent revelations that the Trump administration had secretly obtained the phone records of reporters from the New York Times, the Washington Post, and CNN. Going forward, consistent with the president's direction, the Department of Justice, in a change to its longstanding practice, will not seek compulsory legal process in a leak investigations to obtain source information from members of the news media doing their jobs, Justice Department spokesman Anthony Coley said in a statement Saturday. Yeah, I mean, it's simply wrong to seize journalist records. I can definitely agree with Joe Biden on this one. So Joe Biden actually says this, apparently. So I'll read the whole thing, actually. President Joe Biden recently criticized the policy, saying it's simply wrong to seize journalist records. It's so weird, you know. It's like every once in a while you'll hear something, you know, from somebody you vehemently disagree with on like everything, and they'll actually say something sane. And this sounds very sane to me, what Joe said here. The FBI subpoena to Gannett does not seek the identity of reporter sources or other information gathered during the reporting. Now, that's good, but you shouldn't be seeking the information of who read this news story either. The subpoena issued in April, in fact, they shouldn't even be recording that information, but yeah, unfortunately, you can't control what other people record or don't record. The subpoena issued in April, or you shouldn't, like, from the government should not be able to demand they do or not do that, record that information from their users. Let's put it that way. A subpoena issued in April demanding the production of records containing IP addresses and other identifying information for computers and other electronic devices that access the story during a 35-minute time frame starting at 8:03 p.m. on the day of the shooting. According to the story in question, five FBI agents were shot as they were serving a warrant in a child exploitation case at the West Terrace apartment complex in Sunrise, just outside of Fort Lauderdale, on the morning of February 2nd. Authorities said David Hubber, 55, started shooting and barricaded himself inside a unit before killing himself. Two agents, Daniel Alfin and Laura Schwarzerberger, died. Three were injured, two of whom were hospitalized. It's unclear how the person the FBI was looking for was connected to Hubber. The Justice Department also did not say how investigators found that person. Gannett sought to fight the subpoena, saying it's unconstitutional in violation of the Justice Department's rules about using the legal process to force information out of the press. Maribel Wadsworth, US Today's publisher, said the subpoena came as a surprise given Biden's recent statements supporting reporters, and it's contrary to the Justice Department's guidelines on the narrow circumstances in which the government can subpoena the press. being forced to tell the government who reads what on our website is a clear violation of the First Amendment. Wadsworth said in a statement on Friday, the FBI subpoena asks for private information about readers of our journalism. Gannett on Saturday withdrew its motion, asking a federal judge in Washington, D.C. to invalidate the subpoena. Oh, should not have. I don't feel like he should have withdrawn that, but okay. I mean, obviously it's kind of null and it's calling it null at this point. I probably won't have any future precedent anyway, but I mean, that's how you get like precedent though, is by kind of furthering things along. But anyway, all right. So that's basically it. I guess we're going to have it's a little bit shorter of an episode of Free Talk Live this week because I ran out of stories more or less. We got through quite a bit actually. So that was good. So check out freedomdecrypted.com. Check out thinkpenguin.com for all your computers and accessories needs. We got free software friendly laptops, desktops, printers, Wi-Fi cards, TV tuners, outlet modems, wireless routers, all sorts of different types of accessories. And check out libertyminded.com as well. Libertyminded.com has great freedom-oriented t-shirts, liberty-oriented t-shirts. Think Penguin does too, but there's even more on libertyminded.com. So most of the t-shirts, the liberty-oriented t-shirts on thinkpenguin.com are like technical related stuff, whereas libertyminded.com has some of those t-shirts, and it also has more political-oriented t-shirts as well. So definitely check them out. Libertyminded.com. Libertyminded.com is a sponsor of the show, and one of the prior co-hosts of the show also is the proprietor behind libertyminded.com. So go check it out, libertyminded.com. Everybody have a great day, and see you next week for another episode of Freedom Decrypted.